The longer somebody's in, the more entrenched they get, the more special interest groups support them, and the more that they start thinking about how they should be paid more than what just their salary is.
Taking on Senator Stevens in next week's primary. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, the 19th of August. Good evening, I'm Duncan Moon. Also tonight, establishing the basics on Alaska's rarest coastal breeding bird.
And we're not even sure where they go in the wintertime, period.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. APRN would like to thank Northern Air Cargo for sponsoring Alaska Morning News and Alaska News Nightly. To learn more about this sponsorship, call 907-550-8400.
The legislative investigation into the circumstances surrounding the firing of Public Safety Commissioner Walt Monaghan is focusing on complaints Governor Sarah Palin and her staff made about State Trooper Mike Wooten, who'd been involved in a divorce case with the governor's sister. Senate Judiciary Chairman Hollis French says the investigator, Steve Branchflower, is looking at whether attempts to get Wooten fired affected Monaghan's dismissal. But the investigation report will also include an analysis of whether any state, federal, or local laws were broken by the administration. Among the questions that will likely be included is whether Wooten's personnel rights were protected by the administration's activities, particularly the use of confidential information about him. The governor last weekend released an audio copy of a phone call from her director of boards and commission, Frank Bailey, to Trooper Lieutenant Rodney Dial. Wooten was a major part of the conversation.
You know, he lied on his application when he applied. He said that he didn't have any physical impairments, and come to find out he was rated in the military, and that was discovered after he was hired. But the Palins can't figure out why nothing's going on.
Lieutenant Dial questioned Bailey's use of Wooten's personnel information.
And Frank, where'd you get that information from? I used to be a recruiter, so I'm just, and I know how that that information a lot of times is extremely confidential. So I'm trying to find out how it was determined by anybody that he had indicated something on his application that later found was not to be true.
Well, I'm a little bit reluctant to say, but over in admin is where, you know, we hold workers' comp right in there.
Senator French says from his understanding of the conversation, it seems as if Bailey had exposure to Wooten's confidential personnel information, and Bailey will likely have to explain those statements.
Well, that's certainly going to be, I'm sure, the topic of a lengthy dialogue between Mr. Branchflower and Mr. Bailey to find out exactly, you know, yes or no, did you see it? Yes or, you know, who provided that to you? Under what circumstances did that happen? You know, because it may be that he's operating off of hearsay. It may be someone told him that, which may itself be a violation, but it might not have been Mr. Bailey who actually looked at the document.
French says that all falls to the investigator to look at and present to the committee as necessary. State law holds most personnel records confidential and protects information by making a release a Class A misdemeanor, punishable by as much as a year in prison and a $10,000 fine. Deputy Commissioner of Administration Kevin Brooks says Bailey could have an explanation for his access to the information. Bailey is on administrative leave until the issues are resolved. He did not return phone calls to explain the statements. Senator Ted Stevens is so well known in Alaska that the state's biggest airport is named for him, and he was declared the Alaskan of the 20th century by the Alaska of the Year Committee. But now, after serving in the U.S. Senate for 40 years, he's in the toughest battle of his political life. APRN's Libby Casey has this look at Stevens and his main opponent in next week's Republican primary, real estate developer David Cuddy.
Ted Stevens' story is familiar to Alaskans, a modest upbringing in the lower 48, a World War II pilot, a law school graduate whose career brought him to Alaska, where he became a U.S. attorney. He helped create the state and in 1968 was appointed as one of its senators, winning the seat soon after. In all of the following six elections, he won at least two-thirds of Alaska's vote. But now Stevens' re-election is far from a sure thing. He faces federal criminal charges of lying on his Senate financial disclosure forms to hide over $250,000 in gifts from people the government claims Stevens did favors for. His lawyers asked the courts to fast-track the trial before November's general election, but his innocence or guilt won't be decided until after voters go to the primary polls on August 26th. Stevens says in the meantime, Alaskans should look at his record.
I really believe that I have not done anything that is wrong in the process of my life, my official activities.
Stevens says there's still work to do in the Senate, and his longevity means he can get things done. For example, he hopes to keep Alaska's five major military bases safe from downsizing, even if they're targeted for closure because of the high cost of running them when fuel's so expensive. Stevens does sit on the Defense Appropriations Subcommittee, but lost his seniority on it after the indictment came down last month. Even so, Stevens has power through his lifelong friends and allies in Congress. He says those connections will also help him keep pushing for development in Alaska.
There's no question energy is going to be in the front burner for a long time. We have half the coal in the United States. We have vast areas of Alaska that have been closed to oil and gas exploration, which we think will now be open to oil and gas exploration. And it's going to take a day-to-day monitoring of that and pushing behind it by someone that's in a position to do that, and I am.
In recent months, many politicians, including President Bush and the top presidential candidates, have slammed earmarks, the major way Stevens has brought home the bacon to Alaska. Stevens defends his methods, saying small population states must use earmarks to get what they need. And once again, he says finding the money for Alaska takes his decades spent forging relationships.
I've been here 40 years, and you have made a great investment in my experience and my know-how. Now the question is, do you want me to use it or not?
One of Stevens' main Republican opponents, Dave Cuddy, says it's time for a change. The 55-year-old was born in Anchorage. He represented the city on the state legislature and raised his family there. Cuddy grew up in a banking family and rose through the ranks at First National Bank Alaska, becoming president. He holds a master's in business and has also worked in Lower 48 real estate and the film industry. Cuddy ran for Senate against Stevens 12 years ago, sinking more than $1 million of his own money into the effort, only to garner 27% of the vote. This time, Cuddy isn't spending nearly as much of his own money, and he's not taking an attack approach over Stevens' current legal problems. But as Cuddy said on APRN's Talk of Alaska last month, he is taking aim at the political system Stevens is such a big part of.
The voters reward the politicians, the ones who create a special relationship, special interests, special favors, pork, cookies, any of those things. And as long as the voters reward people for that kind of special interest, the general interest is ignored.
Cuddy says he would vote according to his ethics. He's a staunch pro-lifer and would advocate to limit abortion. He says he would have voted against the Iraq War, unlike Stevens. Cuddy is fiscally conservative, but says two things he'll always vote to fund are roads and veterans, passions he has in common with Stevens. However, Cuddy says, bottom line, Congress should be far more careful with the public's money.
It's easy to just simply be popular and say, oh, yes, we'll increase funding for whatever. But the hard part is to talk about how are you going to fund it.
Cuddy agrees with the Republican Party platform of limited government, but he says that's not what Republicans in Washington have been doing.
This last 12 years, Republicans have been in control, and what have they done? They've cranked up government spending. There's been corruption in all 50 states. There has not been the caring of those things that we need to do to protect and save and nourish this country to hand off to our next generation.
Cuddy says one way to clean up Washington is term limits, which he believes would keep corruption at bay.
The longer somebody's in, the more entrenched they get, the more special interest groups support them, and the more that they start thinking about how they should be paid more than what just their salary is.
Dave Cuddy and Ted Stevens face off for Senate against a handful of other Republicans in next Tuesday's primary. In Washington, D.C., I'm Libby Casey.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, driving a solar-powered car through Alaska with a message.
I think we are all a bunch of hypocrites waiting for a government, someone or something to save the planet for us. It's not going to happen.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
APRN will be providing special coverage of the 50th anniversary of Alaska statehood. For sponsorship information, call 550-8400.
The first initiative that voters will see on the primary ballot next week asks them to decide the future of gambling in Alaska. The measure, as written, will only clean up some long-standing confusion in regulating the charitable gaming industry, but opponents point to other doors the bill would open. APRN's Dave Donaldson reports.
The initiative creates a gaming commission to authorize, regulate, and enforce laws affecting what's now a $350 million charitable gaming industry. And sponsor Darwin Buer says that industry now gets oversight from three executive branch departments.
Everybody that's been in the business, you know, that knows what's going on here realizes that it's kind of a broken system. We need to eliminate the illegal gaming activities. The enforcement is practically nil right now. There's inconsistent management policies and procedures. We just need to have everybody have equal treatment so we have a fair, you know, transparent gaming industry in Alaska.
Anchorage Democrat Harry Crawford, however, says he thinks the measure is deceptive.
What they're trying to do is sell this initiative as more regulation of the charitable gaming industry. And what it is a backdoor attempt to get to for-profit gambling.
Crawford calls it an end run around the legislature that's blocked any gambling for profit expansion several times in recent years. He points to the five voting members of the commission. Three of them make up a quorum that can act without any input and without any veto oversight.
If you've got a quorum of three and two people decide that they want to do something, introduce a casino in Anchorage, they can do it. And, you know, that has all sorts of implications, and I believe that this is something that the legislature should have oversight over, and this governor should certainly have veto power over, and I can't believe that we should be faced with this.
Buer says he expects the commission to act within the public process, reflecting the public's will.
You know, there's not the commission. I just don't see it. They're not going to come in and just put up huge, big, flashy casinos anywhere because our polling has shown Alaskans don't want that. You know, so they're not going to do something stupid like that. Hopefully, the governor is going to appoint some level-headed, fair-minded people that are really, you know, just take a legitimate look at what's going on and clean up what's going. You know, just clean everything up and get our ducks in line, which they certainly are not right now.
If the initiative passes, it would go into effect early next year. Commission members would have to be confirmed by the legislature. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
Exploratory drilling is underway at the Bokan Mountain mining site on the south end of Prince of Wales Island in southeast. Landmark Alaska wants to reopen the 50-year-old mine, which it hopes contains sizable amounts of uranium and rare earth elements. KRBD's Deanna Garrison reports.
Landmark Alaska is the American subsidiary of British Columbia-based Ucore Uranium. Clifford Hansen is the Landmark general manager. He says the historic mine, which hasn't operated since 1971, is Ucore's flagship property.
Bokan Mountain is Alaska's only historic uranium mine. It produced almost 1.5 million pounds of uranium from 1958 to 1971. The U.S. Geologic Survey has estimated that there could be as much as 11 million more pounds in that area. It is also a world-class rare earth element deposit.
Hansen says Bokan Mountain is one of North America's largest deposits of rare earth elements. He says rare earth elements are used to manufacture lithium batteries, computer monitors, cell phones, and other commonly used goods. He describes the uranium deposit as small to medium-sized, but says the concentration of uranium is one of the highest in the nation. 35 years ago, Hansen says uranium was a hot commodity, but prices plunged after disasters at nuclear plants in Chernobyl and Three Mile Island. Once again, he says uranium has has gained favor with investors, which could make development of the site economically feasible.
In the last few years, uranium has become, much to my surprise, has become much more interesting. People are now talking about it as being back to being an alternative for power supply that is, doesn't contribute to the greenhouse gas situation. And that is why now uranium has rebounded in price substantially. It was in 30 years ago, the price was $6 a pound. Recently, it was trading at $90 a pound. So it's almost as good as being in oil.
He says no specific buyers have been lined up, but says the major markets for uranium are in France and Korea. Hansen says the previous operators of the mine stopped in 1971 after completing a contract with the federal government. He says there's no historical documentation that the uranium deposits were depleted when the mine shut down. Hansen says his company has been working on the Bokan project for 2 years, signing agreements with claim holders, applying for Forest Service permits, and mapping the area. He says Landmark, which now owns almost 500 claims to the Bokan site, began drilling in June.
As we speak, they better be out there drilling. For a while, we had two drill rigs running 24 hours a day. We gained additional permits to move on to new areas around the mountain, so we've been moving the drill rigs around.
Between 2011 and 2013, Hansen says his company hopes to obtain mine permits and construct the mine. He estimates the mine would provide between 100 and 1,000 direct jobs. In Ketchikan, I'm Deanna Garrison.
The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the U.S. Geological Survey are teaming up to fund a research project aimed at studying a rare coastal bird in Alaska. Kittlitz's murrelets are the rarest breeding bird in coastal Alaska. Recently, it was discovered that they use part of Kodiak Island as their breeding grounds. To date, there have only been 40 nests documented statewide. James Lowen, a seasonal field biology technician for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, has been studying the birds this summer, along with two other researchers. He says they documented four nests on the southwest portion of Kodiak Island, where they had their camp set up.
Camp was set up the Sturgeon River drainage, actually between the Sturgeon River and Yaikuluk River drainages, and we set up the camp with three helicopter trips from Grant's Lagoon. We flew in our about 2,200 pounds of gear and three crew members out to Grant's Lagoon and then ferried stuff from the floatplane site to, with helicopters to our field site.
Lawan says this was the first year of a five-year study. Researchers have two main sites they're observing.
The study's been going on Kodiak Island and on Agatu Island on the Maritime Refuge. It's on the Aleutian chain. And the study's being conducted on these two islands rather than on their more typical habitats in near glaciers, just because it's a lot easier to access nests and a lot easier to do a lot of the studies we're doing here than it is in near these really remote habitats near glaciers.
The research gathered at these sites will be used as baseline information to make studying these birds in their remote and natural habitats a little easier, especially since there isn't a whole lot known about the bird yet.
Once we establish that they were there is to characterize, you know, what kind of habitats they prefer. And then also to determine the second part of the study was to pretty much figure out the behavior that these birds are showing on the breeding grounds, because it's new to science. We don't really know, or we didn't really know what they do, you know, when they're doing their thing. One, to establish that Kittlitz's murrelets are using certain areas of the refuge for nesting, just to determine what the habitat they're using. And the last part is to try to figure out, you know, what exactly do these birds do on the breeding grounds.
He says what makes the Kittlitz's murrelets even more mysterious is the fact that no one knows where they disappear to in the winter months.
See, this is a good question. We're not even sure where they go in the wintertime, period. So they're definitely, it's a seabird, so this kind of bird actually forages at sea, spends most of the year at sea. Again, we're not sure where in the wintertime. And then during the breeding season, they'll come ashore, sometimes up to 50 kilometers, we think, to nest, and they'll fly back to the ocean once nesting is complete. And that's a lot different than other seabirds, which tend to nest right on cliffs right on the ocean.
Kittlitz's murrelet populations were estimated at 100,000 15 years ago. But for unknown reasons, they've been dropping about 15% each year. Lowen says their population today is only estimated at 15,000 birds, and that they hope to figure out why their numbers are declining. Kittlitz's murrelets populate rocky, vegetation-free areas and cliffs located in and around the glaciers of coastal Alaska. They're most common in southeast and south central.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
9 out of 10 of Alaska's boating fatalities are adult males. Most drown following an unexpected fall or capsize into cold water. Cold water can kill the unprepared, regardless of swimming ability. Wearing a life jacket can make the difference between life and death. Make your family's boating memories good ones. Always wear a life jacket when boating Alaska's cold water. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
A solar-powered car is traveling through Alaska. The vehicle, built and driven by Marcella Deleuze of Toronto, is headed south after stopping in Fairbanks last week. The journey began in Buffalo, New York, 2 months ago. Since then, Deleuze and his Power of One team have covered nearly 6,000 miles in an effort to break the solar power distance record of more than 8,000 miles. But Deleuze says his journey is about more than just a record.
What I'm trying to do is save the planet on my own way. I consider myself a part-time tree hugger, and I'd like to do my share for the environment, and this is how I'm doing, by driving a car that runs on light. I believe there is technology that we could be using, but we lack the political will. I think we are all a bunch of hypocrites waiting for a government, someone or something to save the planet for us. It's not going to happen. We have to take charge, we have to take ownership, and do our share. If we all did a little bit, we could do a lot.
Deleuze has to lie nearly horizontal in the low-slung single-seat car. The cockpit is enclosed in a sleek foam and fiberglass canopy covered with 280 solar cells. The car is about 15 feet long and less than 3 feet high. He says the solar car has been mistaken for a UFO and that he's often pulled over by police. He says his most unusual encounter was with a wolf that investigated the car while he was taking a break along the Dempster Highway.
I'm a city guy, and I thought the wolf was friendly, and I walked towards the wolf, and the wolf walked towards me, and he tried to bite my leg, but then I got a little upset, and took a step back, and then tried to bite my leg again, and then I got more upset, and I changed the tone of my voice, and it walked away. And
the Scholar car has been powered exclusively by the sun on its tour, but Deleuze is accompanied by a conventional van carrying his support crew and spare parts. The Alaska Maritime National Wildlife Refuge stretches from the islands in the Gulf of Alaska to the end of the Aleutian Chain. It's managed as a resource for Alaskans, but only a lucky few will get to experience it. KIAL's Ann Hillman spoke with two photographers who are trying to bring the Maritime Refuge to life for the rest of us.
Tom Colopy and Mary Frisch sit in a bouncing skiff taking photos of remote parts of Unalaska Island.
If that rock face in there had a little light on it.
They constantly change out lenses, play with their settings, and pass the two cameras back and forth, making it unclear who took which image.
And when people ask us, who took that picture, we say, we don't know. One of us did. It's so much easier than saying, well, I got that one and he got that one. But if they persist, I said, well, mine are the only ones that are in focus.
The couple started shooting together 12 years ago after their late-in-life marriage. They started their nature photography business on a whim.
When we decided to just leave everything in Minnesota and move up here, our accountant says, sounds very prosaic, but our accountant says, make it a business, it'll pay for the move. That's how it started.
On this excursion, they're traveling through the Aleutians to shoot a large-scale exhibit featuring the landscapes and wildlife of the Alaska Maritime National Wildlife Refuge for the Islands and Oceans Visitor Center in Homer. Though they've done shows with large panoramas before, the Maritime Refuge offers new challenges.
We haven't ever tried to do a panorama from a moving platform, and it definitely is going to create challenges putting things together, but I don't think the problems will be insurmountable.
They're trying to capture the enormity of the landscapes, unending green hillsides and craggy gray rocks, for people who will probably never get a chance to see them.
Trying to produce images that give the viewer the sense of what it's like to be out in a place like this. That's a kind of a daunting task.
That means hoping the light is right to shoot hundreds of photos in only a few days, then trying to stitch them together to produce 2-foot by 8-foot images and even larger. Though their photos have been featured in galleries and museums around the state, they're still hypercritical of their own work.
Half a dozen times a year, sometimes at the same time, sometimes at different times, each one of us will look at the work that we've done and just say, why do we even do this? You know, we ought to get rid of our cameras and just go hire somebody to do it.
I think what brings us back, makes us pick up the camera again, is that sense of beauty, a sense of awe, a sense of wonder. And you do want to share that.
They also work hard to make sure they share more than just work with each other.
When we're working together, usually myself or him insists on stopping the work and just hugging each other, giving each other a hug, remind each other why we're here and what we're doing.
And they're trying to remind Alaskans what the Maritime Refuge can mean to them. In Onalaska, I'm Ann Hillman.
An Alaskan is preparing for a rare opportunity to talk to a major presidential candidate. Holly Stebbing was studying abroad when she first heard of Barack Obama. She was inspired to start making small monthly contributions to his campaign because of speeches she watched on YouTube.
It said that Barack Obama actually wanted increased funding for Indian Health Services, and he was actually one of the only candidates who I'd heard of or who was planning on increasing funding for Indian Health Services, and that's something that I feel strongly about.
Earlier this summer, the campaign challenged supporters to write a short essay about why they support Senator Obama and submit it along with their donation. Stebbing turned in an essay and received a phone call for an interview. She spoke about Indian health care, offshore drilling, and other issues unique to Alaska. She was chosen as one of 10 people across the country who will meet with presidential hopeful at the Democratic National Convention in Denver, Colorado. Stebbing is Inupiaq. She's also a Native American Studies major at Stanford University, and this summer has been working on her senior honors thesis. She received funding from Stanford to travel throughout the state to interview Native and non-Native elders about racial segregation in Alaska.
I really enjoyed speaking with our elders and getting their stories down because, you know, like I've grown up hearing these stories from my grandmother, but we don't learn these things in school, and like we need to record these things now.
Stebbing will fly to Denver next week to meet Obama. She'll talk about the issues outlined in her essay, but also about increasing Native American participation in government. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Deanna Garrison in Ketchikan, Mary Donaldson in Kodiak, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Ann Hillman in Unalaska, Jennifer Canfield in Anchorage. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Dave Waldron is our audio engineer. John Prophet is our webmaster. And I'm Duncan Moon. From all of us here at the Alaska Public Radio Network, have a good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
BP. Proud to support public broadcasting in Alaska.
The University of Alaska College Savings Plan, providing tax-advantaged college savings options for Alaska families. T. Rowe Price Investment Services Incorporated, distributor, underwriter. Information at 1-888-4, and then Alaska. And by
First National Bank Alaska, working shoulder-to-shoulder with Alaskan businesses for nearly a century. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
Didn't quite catch that report? Want to hear it again? APRN can be heard on the web at www.aprn.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.